chapters 4 and 5 tonight. I'm just going to tell you, this has been a real interesting study for me. Lamentations is one of those books that we don't really look at a lot for whatever the reason is. At least it's been my experience. Maybe you've had a different experience. But in going through this, and I think especially since I was teaching, you always hear, and it's very true, if you're the teacher, you always look at things a little harder and have to prepare a little bit more. So you pick up on things you probably wouldn't ordinarily do, and that's very true for me. And in going through this, and it's been a real eye-opener for me as to what this book is hopefully all about, if I picked up on the right things. And we'll touch on some of those things as we go through. Especially last week I mentioned that what I wanted us to do at one point during the study here tonight was to take a look at, you know, just kind of take a step back and give it a little bit 30,000-foot level view, if you want to call it that, and say, okay, what exactly is the theme here, and how does it apply to us? What is it teaching us? And we're going to do that as we transition from chapter 4 to chapter 5. Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and get started. If we could have somebody read the first 10 verses of chapter 4. Again, we're going to talk about the siege of Jerusalem. Go ahead, Josh.
How the gold has lost its luster. Fine gold become dull. The sacred gems are scattered at every street corner. How the precious children of Zion, once worth their weight in gold, are now considered as pots of clay, the work of a potter's hands. Even jackals offer their breasts to nurse their young. But my people have become heartless like ostriches in the desert. Because of thirst, the infant's tongue sticks to the roof of its mouth. The children beg for bread, but no one gives it to them. Those who once ate delicacies are destitute in the streets. Those who brought up royal and purple now lie on ash heaps. The punishment of my people is greater than that of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment without a hand turned to help her. Their princes were brighter than snow and whiter than milk. Their bodies more ruddy than rubies. Their appearance like lapis lazuli. But now they're blacker than soot. They're not recognized in the streets. Their skin is shriveled on their bones. It's become as dry as a stick. Those killed by the sword are better off than those who die of famine. Racked with hunger, they waste away from the lack of food in the field. With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own children, who became their food when my people were destroyed.
Yeah, thank you. So, first question I had here, you know, it talks about these verses describe the vividly describe the degradation of Jerusalem during the siege. And just how far, when you read these verses, how far has Jerusalem fallen? What are some of the things that you saw in here just to tell you how far they've fallen? I don't know if you can get much lower than that. You know, you talk about desperation and just complete hopelessness. You get to that point where you're eating your own children. Absolutely. Anything else that jumped out at you?
A couple things. It's like they're not even recognizable. The names who they were, and the ones who remain are worse off, actually, than the ones who killed.
Yeah. Any others? So, yeah, y'all picked up. Same thing. There's no way to, in one slide, to effectively put all of the verses and the points up here. But so I try to capture at least a few of them there. No, it just talks about how the gold has lost its luster, and different versions kind of got that or translated that verse a little differently. It talks about stones, and some were temple stones, some were the gems of the temple, the jewels, or whatever. So. That's the reason why that gem, it's supposed to have been gems, I messed up, or it has a question mark beside it, but they're scattered, the infants are starving, the once wealthy that used to eat delicacies and everything, they are now desolate in the streets, and I like the way yours read, Joshua, that they are lying down on ash heaps. My version, as you can see, reads embraces ash heaps. These once clean, shiny nobles, as y'all, this is one of the ones y'all pointed out, black and unrecognizable. They're eating their young. They remain worse off than those killed. one of the verses that kind of struck me too was how it talks about in verse 6, it's their iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the sin of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment, and no hands were turned toward her. To me, it's just like, you know, you get this picture of Sodom and the fire and brimstone and everything raining down on it. But for them, it's, you know, to me, and you can tell me if this is the way you're reading this or not. It's like, okay, but at least there's, you know, it was over like that. That, you know, the fire and brimstone came in, destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. They were done. This, especially for those that were not killed, is just a longer, they wish they were dead. They wish that they had just been killed in an instant like those in Sodom and Gomorrah were. But they're having to live with the aftermath in there. And I think, you know, when you're reading through this, it just comes to the conclusion that, you know, they have just fallen from whatever heights that they were, in, whether it's reality or in their own minds or whatever, they're all brought very low. They're all brought as low as you can be. And I think that's an important thing to see in this chapter. We're going to talk more about this at the end of the chapter. But I think it's a real important thing to see at the beginning.
Kind of goes along with what Larry said about eating the young. I think, like, you know, there's always, in any kind of, like, calamity, the good news stories of people that are, like, banding together to, like, suffer through it or sacrifice from one another. Mm-hmm. But in this case, that's not happening. And I think the verse 3, even the jackals aren't the rest of the young, but you become, like, heartless, like, ostriches in the desert. And I looked that up, and I think, like, the ostriches, they'll lay their eggs, and I guess they have enough nutrients in the egg sac. In the
they just leave them.
They can, like, last for 6 or 7 days so they don't ever get their own food. So they just leave the eggs mm-hmm. there in the middle of nowhere. And you have, like, parents and their children, like, friends and neighbors that are just so brought so low that they're not even remotely concerned with anyone other than themselves. Mm-hmm. It's not, there's no, like, nobility to this suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. No, yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know any other ways to describe it. They are brought very, very low. Whoops. Okay. I said we were going to talk about it later on, and actually we're going to get to it a little sooner. I forgot exactly the order I had things. The next question I asked along with this was why this punishment and humiliation was necessary. And I mentioned in the questions I sent out, there were two of these verses, and as I was doing final preparations, another one came to mind that we had saw in chapter 12. But, you know, when we think about why this humiliation was necessary, I think our minds go back a lot to at least one place where it would be to 2 Chronicles 36, because talking about, well, let me just ask you, when you're looking at these verses, why would this punishment be necessary and also the humiliation that they've experienced? What's the obvious reason why it's necessary? Yeah. Yeah, because of their sins, they didn't listen to God's message, their sins, their disobedience. And that's where we go to, I think, it's where my mind goes to. But what other reasons are given? And this is one reason why I threw in the Lamentations. In this verse, it talks about their prophets had seen false visions and deceptive vision, or false and deceptive visions. They have not uncovered your iniquity to bring you back to slaves. And we talked about that, to where you need to understand your sin before you can start recovering from it. So when you're talking about this what this does, not only are they being punished for their sins, and in many cases killed, for the most part killed. You know, in our last lesson on Jeremiah, there at the end of the final chapter, it talks about the number of people that actually got taken into captivity. And did you notice how, relatively speaking, few that was? I mean, the first wave is where most of them went. Less than 1,000 in the next two. If memory serves me, it's only like 4,600. Out of how many people? When he's talking about a remnant, he was talking about a remnant. There weren't many people that survived. Only, you know, less than 5,000 were taken into captivity. So when you're talking about this humiliation and everything here, another reason, and we'll just kind of keep going here, is not only to punish for their sins, but to help them realize their sins, recognize it, and the extent to which they have fallen away from their Lord in order that they might begin to recover. That last verse that I had up there was the first beatitude. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You've got to be spiritually destitute and really reach that point before you can begin the process. And that's what they're needing to do here.
Go ahead. I think one other point to make why the punishment and humiliation is necessary is that the cautionary tale. And you mentioned this back in Deuteronomy 29. And God even went so far as telling the people through Moses, you're going to eat your own children. You're going to be worse off in Sodom and Gomorrah. And then he says in verse 24 of chapter 29, all the nations, you know, when they see this, they'll ask, why has the Lord done this to the land? Why this fierce burning anger? And the answer will be, it's because this people abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their ancestors, the covenant there with them when he brought them out of Egypt.
Yeah.
They went on to worship other gods. So now the whole world sees what's happened to these people as a, you know, a message.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead. Good point. Anything else on this part?
That reminds me of Luke 12 when he says, to whom much has been given, much is required.
Yeah.
Which is, I think brings up Hebrews 11, I think it's in chapter 10 or 11. Yeah. In chapter 10, he says, you know, you, such a great, you know, calamity comes upon you for denying Moses and the law, how much more for, you know, trampling on the blood of the covenant, blessed in the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Now, that's one thing that was pointed in the New Testament that Paul, in many of his writings, looks back and talks about how, you know, they had that gift. They, you know, of they were God's people. They had the law. More was expected from them. They didn't live up to it, and everything. So yeah, no, all good points. All right. So as we move on, if I could get somebody to read verses 11 through 16. Go ahead, Dan. Yeah, go ahead.
The Lord has fulfilled his fury. He has poured out his fierce anger. He kindled a fire with his eye, and he has devoured his foundations. The kings of the earth and all the inhabitants of the world do not have belief, but the adversary of the enemy who entered the gates of the earth. Because of the sins of the prophets and the iniquities of the priests, who shed and purpose the blood of the just. They wandered blind in the streets,
all right. So, you know, in the first couple of verses there, 11, 12, you know, it talks about how he's accomplished his wrath. He's poured out his fierce anger. He's kindled a fire in Zion, which has consumed its foundations. Just, you know, if you didn't have enough of a picture yet as to what's been happening, you know, that ought to add to it. But then, and this is, you know, kind of what Josh was just referring to here. He states it again here, how these kings of the earth and everybody wouldn't have believed this. You know, how in the world would the Lord allow an adversary to enter the gates of Jerusalem? They just wouldn't think that was possible, yet it has happened. And I find that interesting because, you know, in Jeremiah we talk about how the children of Israel, the folks in Jerusalem, thought they were safe because they were in Jerusalem, because they were where the temple was. So they thought they were safe. But I find it interesting, all these references to the nations round about kind of had that same idea, apparently, that they didn't think. They find it just astounding that the Lord was going to allow the enemy to come into Jerusalem the way he did here. You know, it's one thing to be put in submission, subjection, but to come in and destroy Jerusalem the way he did here, that just seems to be unfathomable to the nations round about them. So, just
how many years is this after the Rabshakeh came to Jerusalem and then, you know, had that huge loss, tens of thousands of people died and they had to turn back?
The who came to Jerusalem?
The Rabshakeh.
The Rabshakeh. What?
During Hezekiah's reign, he was like the military commander.
Oh. Okay. I was thinking of Sennacherib. Never the king, everything. Very roughly speaking, okay, you had Hezekiah, you had Manasseh after that, who was 52 years. You had two more after that. Josiah was 31. Call it maybe 100, between 100 and 150 years, very roughly speaking. Because this would have been, this is at the end, so this is too, I'd have to go back if somebody wants to do the math real quick. And let us know when you figure it out. But off the top of my head, about there somewhere, maybe. Maybe I went a little high. But let's see. Okay. But then as it goes in here, it was interesting also to me that, you know, how he points out and singles out the prophets and the priests here. So they're singled out as a focal point in this wrath. Why are they to blame? Verse 13 gives us a real good reason there. Yeah, you know, talks about here how because of the sins of the prophets and their iniquities of the priests who have shed in her midst the blood of the righteous. You know, they didn't provide the spiritual leadership that they should. They should have been the ones standing up and supporting all these prophets that have come through. And, you know, Bill, how many times did you have to point out in Jeremiah, okay, who are the ones that are really going after Jeremiah here? It was the prophets and the priests. They're the ones that were going after him. King Zedekiah, you know, as weak as he was, he wasn't really going after Jeremiah that way. Now, some of the people around him and some of the other kings leading up to there were, but it was the priest, the spiritual leaders who were fighting the true prophets of God tooth and nail all through this time. It's just amazing. Okay, so they're doing this, they're shedding the blood of the innocents. We've studied about this before and everything. Especially Manasseh was, you know, the one king that is really noted for that. According to Jewish tradition, he sawed Isaiah in half. Among the others that he killed, shed so much innocent blood there. So because of all this sin that they did, they're being brought up for that. And what's their end, according to verses 14 through 16? Yeah, they're wandering around blind in the streets. And then you have the reaction of the people. They don't want to touch them. They're like, depart, unclean, unclean. Go away. And it ends there where neither the Lord or the people are regarding them. There's no respect anymore for the elders and the priest. So it's a kind of a folk, I don't know if you want to call it, but a singular view here on these people and how far they've fallen. And just the punishment and everything that they're going through. You talk about losing your position and everything. These people have really fallen there to where nobody wants anything to do. Nobody regards them anymore. If for no other reason, it's obvious they've been proven wrong. All the false prophecies and everything have been proven to be just that false. And Jeremiah has been proven right. I'm sure he's not gloating about it. as we saw in Jeremiah, and we're not seeing that here in Lamentations. But, you know, the true prophets have been proven right in this. Who would like to read verses 17 through 22 as we finish chapter 4? Go ahead, Brad.
Still our eyes failed us, watching vainly for our hope. And our watching we watch for a nation that did not save us. We track our steps so that we could not walk in our streets. Our end was near, our days were over, for our end had come. Our pursuers were swifter than the peoples of the heavens. They pursued us on the mountains and laid away for us in the wilderness. The breath of our nostrils, the anointed of the Lord, was caught in their voice. Unholy said, under his shadow we shall live among the nations. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, you who dwell in the land of Buzz. The cup shall also pass over to you. You shall become drunk and make yourself naked. The punishment of your iniquity is accomplished, O daughter of Zion. You no longer sing your testimony.
All right. Thank you. So, first question I asked on these verses is, you know, specifically looking at 17 through 20, how they describe Jerusalem's devastating final days. Ask again, why has this come upon them as far as these verses are concerned? Verses 17 and 20 specifically. So what do those two verses tell us? And I've got those up there so you can read them. Okay, so they're putting their trust in a nation that couldn't save them. And then what else? In verse 20, I think this is just an interesting way. Yeah, that's the way I was reading it. You know, they put their trust in people that they wouldn't be able to deliver them. And it appears, I read the same way you did, that they failed to understand. You know, they thought they could live under the Lord's shadow and that everything would be fine. They didn't understand what they really needed to do, how they needed to truly submit to him, to truly be under his shadow of protection and everything. So, you know, is that a problem today? Yeah. See a few nods. You know, how many people think that, hey, I believe in God or I recognize there is a God and he's going to be, I'll be fine. But it's like not understanding that need to submit to him. It's more than just acknowledging that God exists. We have to submit ourselves to him and obey him. Okay, and they failed to see that, obviously. The last couple of verses, you know, talk about here. It's interesting to me. Most of these five, at tail end of these five chapters, has this little almost side message or something, if you want to call it that, a little segue. And this one's talking about Edom, and basically it's obviously hitting up there right now here. So what's the message to Edom? Yeah, I know you're rejoicing right now, but guess what? You're going to get it too. And everything here. So, why he included that here, I don't know. It's just kind of interesting to me. But when we do get to the end, as I was reading this and comparing it, a question that I did kind of have in my own head, and I just want to kind of throw it out to you, is that, okay, chapter 4 is similar to chapter 1. You know, chapter 1's talking about the devastation of Jerusalem through the eyes of Jeremiah, but also kind of the last half of that chapter is looking at it through the eyes of Jerusalem and Jerusalem being personified and looking at the devastation of Jerusalem through Jerusalem's eyes, what's happened to her people and everything. And in this chapter, we're seeing the aftermath of the siege and everything. So is this just a repeat? Is the message the same as what chapter 1 was about and this is just a repeat? Or is there a different message here? Is it being stated for a different reason? And I highlighted the verses 22 from each of those chapters, chapter 1 and chapter 22, to see if that might give you an idea as to where my mind might be going. Do you see a difference? Or am I reading too much between the lines? And I think that's the key. If you couldn't hear Josh, where he talks about it, there's a light at the end of the tunnel given in chapter 4, but that's not there in chapter 1. And, you know, in chapter 1, it talks about here, for the telling, and you see what I highlighted there. My sighs are many and my heart is faint. I just, you know, when you read that chapter, the way I just described it would be shell-shocked hopelessness. They're just looking around and just being shell-shocked. What's happened here? What are we going to do? Just not understanding anything. You know, when you see people, and if you, I don't know, some of you may have actually experienced this when you're talking about a tornado or a hurricane whipping through an area, a locale. And when people, especially if you're talking about a tornado where people are coming out of their storm shelters and just looking around at the devastation, their house that was right there is scattered around in pieces. And all sorts of things here. Just what do we do? Same thing. Probably on a scale much higher. But that same type of feeling. But in chapter 4, he's going through all this punishment and everything that's happened to him. But then what's he say? Tell him. The punishment of your iniquity is accomplished. It's done. He will no longer send you into captivity. So now he's letting them know that the punishment is accomplished. The worst is over. So now there's this hope that they had that wasn't there before. Okay. So couldn't tell if somebody was twitching a hand or whatever. And I think that's important because that kind of leads into the next part of this, because as we transition to chapter 4 to chapter 5, I think it's a good place to look at, because we're going into a prayer for restoration. And before we read anything here, let's just kind of talk about some things as to why this prayer for restoration might come last. Why might that be the case? Could he have started off with a prayer of restoration and then maybe said, okay, please restore us. Here's what you've done to us. But he didn't. It's last. Why might that be the case? Any ideas? Apparently not. Exactly. I think that's exactly it. When you look at this, it's the last step in the process, is the way I put it. And when you look at these chapters that we've had, first of all, you have that hopelessness in the first lamentation. You have that hopelessness. They're looking around, the devastation, the punishment's happening, and they're just shell-shocked, as we just talked about. And then you follow that right up in the second chapter with Yahweh's anger. Here's why all this has happened. If you didn't know yet, now you know why all this has happened to you. The Lord told you it was going to happen. He told you he was getting mad. You wouldn't listen to him. And guess what? He's poured his wrath out on you. He gave you every chance to avoid it, and you wouldn't listen. So you're looking around at the devastation, wondering why it's happened. Now you know why it's happened. And then you go from that, where the understanding is beginning. At least now you know who is doing this to you. So you, in the third lamentation, you go begging for mercy to the one who is causing all this, who's pouring out this wrath on you. Lord, have mercy on us. Please stop. Remember that we're your children. Please stop. And then, once you have that, now that recognition is starting to come into play. Yeah, you're looking at the same devastation and everything, but now you're looking through it, if you want to call it educated eyes, or at least better understanding. Okay, we have this devastation, but now we understand exactly why we have failed. We have not lived up to the Lord's standard. We have failed Him, and now we want to start looking. Now we have hope, as we were talking about at the very tail end. The punishment's over. We have hope, so now let's start building on that hope that we can go to, and now let's pray for restoration. That relationship that we had once with our Lord can be restored once again. Okay, but that has to, those first four things have to happen before you can pray for restoration effectively. Okay, does that all make sense, or am I again reading too much between the lines? Because I think that hopefully I'm not reading too much into it, but to me that helps answer the question as to, okay, why would you have this in there? Well, for the Jews, you're going to have it in there because as a reminder as to, okay, here's the devastation that occurred. Here's what the Lord did to you, and here was that aftermath. You really need these lamentations there to carry that message on and to bring this to mind. It's one thing to hear about how Nebuchadnezzar and his army come in and destroy Jerusalem. It's another thing to hear and vividly see that devastation as proclaimed by Jeremiah in these lamentations and why this is happening in the way that he is pointed out here. So I think these lamentations help provide at the very least a memorial of sorts and a reminder to the children of Israel to help keep them straight as they're recovering, so to speak, in captivity, but then when they come back, that will hopefully help keep them straight so that this doesn't happen again. We know what happens in 70 AD. But we see this. But then the next question is, how might these lamentations, in the order that they were given, what might help, why would they be there for us? What might they help us see for us in application to us? Go ahead. Yeah. Right. No, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I keep saying process. I wasn't trying to make this a checklist. That's coming across, but that's not what I'm doing. It's just you had five lamentations here. There's five lamentations for a reason. Okay, and it's showing what has to happen, and it's the same for us. What they had to go through to truly be able to pray for restoration and to achieve restoration with the Lord is the same thing we have to do. We've got to, you know, understand our hopeless situation due to our sin. We can do nothing of ourselves to rectify that. And we got to recognize why this is happening, why we have a broken relationship with our Father. And that's, as we kind of alluded to before, that's where a lot of people fail to, that's the thing that a lot of people in our world today fail to see. They don't see a broken relationship, or they fail to understand why there's a broken relationship, okay, with the Lord. So until you understand those things, it's impossible to be restored because you're not seeing a need for it, okay? But then that humility that starts kicking in, to reach out to Him, ask for mercy, to accept that grace and mercy. And I'm kind of paraphrasing a little bit here to fit it a little bit more with ours situation today. And then to start building that relationship, to ask Him to restore that relationship. And over on the that side, my left, your right, a few verses. On things like this, my mind always goes to the first three Beatitudes, where He's talking about the poor in spirit, those that mourn, and the meek. Okay? I think that's, so, you know, when you think about what that is, if you're going to be poor in spirit, that's talking about being spiritually destitute. It's not talking about somebody who just doesn't have quite as much money as they would like to have. You're talking about being destitute, and you've got to be spiritually destitute. You've got to understand your situation, okay? And you've got to not only understand it, but you've got to mourn it. You got to want out of it. There's a lot of people who are physically destitute that are they're perfectly fine in that. They don't want to get out of it because they're comfortable in there, they understand it, and they're okay. But to get out of that situation, you got to want to be out of it. You got to mourn it. And then you got to realize you can't do it by yourself. You got to be meek. You got to put yourself in somebody else's hands who can help you out of there and bring you out of there. And that's where they were at. That's where we're at. I just used Acts 2:37 as one example where we see this. Peter has just finished his sermon. You can just picture the Jews looking at each other. Oh, man, look at what we've done. And they turned to Peter and the rest of the apostles. Men and brethren, what shall we do? They understand their situation. They're mourning their situation. They know they have to do something. Tell us. What do we do? And then, as Romans 5 clearly shows us, how God has provided that means for reconciliation. He's restored that relationship. Even while we were enemies, Christ died for us. So it's there for us. But that process, for lack of a better word, we have to do that. You can't have one without the other. It has to start with our own humility, our own understanding of our spiritual situation, and wanting to get out of that and to build that relationship once again with the Father. Okay? Any other thoughts or anything there on that before we get into chapter 5? Okay. Well, let's see here. Tell you what, if we can do this the easy way, maybe we can split this up between two or three people, but just read the whole chapter, all 22 verses. If somebody wants to take the first, we can take the first seven maybe, and we can get three people here real quick, just so it's not all on one person. Go ahead, Wade.
Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to foreigners. Yet the orphans, fatherless, our mothers are like this. We must pay for the water we drink, the wood we get. Our pursuers are at our necks. We are weary. We are given no rest. We have given the land a hand to Egypt and to Syria to get bread enough. Our fathers sinned and are no more, and we bear their iniquities.
All right. Hey, who would like to take Keith? Okay, 8 through 14, please. And then one last 15 through the end. You go last, you get one more verse. Go ahead. Thank you all for reading it. So the first question I asked was just when you're looking at the first 18 verses documenting their disgrace and how and what has fallen on them. And I broke it up into these sections, verses 1 through 6, 7 through 9, 10 through 13, 14 through 15, 16 through 18. Just to try to sum up each of those things. What are the things in general that are addressed in each of those sections? When you're looking at verses 1 through 6, what are the types of things that are being talked about there?
Well,
Yeah, essence of their livelihood. That's a good way to put it. See here. See if I got the... Okay. Let's try and make sure. Okay, I did put the animation right on this one. You know, they've lost their inheritance. They're now orphans and widows. No rest for the weary. All sorts of things in there along that line. So, yeah, that's a good way to sum it up, the loss of their livelihood. Okay, so when you're looking at 7 through 9, what's kind of... It's a related but a little different. What are they talking about here? Okay. A lot of physical torment, specifically their servitude, the slavery they're going through, and everything there. It talks about how there's no, you know, their slaves rule over them now. Okay? Where once they ruled over the slaves, now the slaves are ruling over them. Okay? Due to the sin of the Father, and there's none to deliver them. Okay? In 10 through 13, what are we seeing there? Sickness and death, and what else?
Violation.
Yeah, that's a good word, way better. Yeah, just all this. I went one too far. Yeah, okay. Well, you got the answer for the next one. Effects of famine, vicious acts. Talk about what's happening to the women there, the captives and everything. The old men no longer in the gate. I went one too far there. 14 through 15, you see the resulting impact on people that they have there. And then what's happening in 16 and 18? You've gone through all this stuff here for verses 1 through 15, all these things that are happening. But in 16 and 18, what's happening?
They recognize their own sin.
There you go. Now you have the realization of their sin. They're recognizing it now. Okay. So they're accepting their sin. They're accepting that this is happening because of their sin. They brought it on themselves. Okay? So, what they're, in a lot of ways, I think the first part of this prayer for restoration, and you see this, you know, when we're going to talk about, you know, going into Daniel starting in 2 Wednesdays from now and everything, and when you're looking at his prayers that he's praying and others that do this, it's just an example. What's the first thing they do? Talking about the sins of their people and looking for forgiveness of those sins before they do say anything else. Okay, so in this prayer for restoration, the most of this prayer is acknowledging their sins and the effects of those sins on them. Okay, but acknowledging their sins before God. And then that takes us into the last part of this. It discusses their turning to the Lord. What are the things addressed in verses 19, 20, and 21 through 22? In verse 19, what do we see? What are they acknowledging there? Who are they acknowledging there? Yeah, the Lord, the power, His power. You know, the recognition and submission to the Lord's eternal throne. Okay, so now they've acknowledged their sin. Now let's acknowledge the Lord and show who He is. Verse 20, what's happening?
Warning.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. One of the way I put it here was that, you know, why does He continue to forget them? Everything there. So looking to Him, and asking that question, it's recognizing we need You. We can't get out of this without You. So please remember us and don't leave us like this. And in verses 21 through 22, I have a few points here, but what are they really doing here in verses 21 through 22? What's the first thing they ask Him in verse 21? Restore us. Okay, and then what else is He talking about here? And that's basically it. We'll just go ahead and jump to it here. We're actually going to finish a minute ahead of time. Imagine that. But restore us to Yourself. Renew our days like they were, unless You've given up on us. You know, you talk about the despair that's still there. It's like, okay, they've come to the point where they realize this is the only one who can get us out of this. And if he's given up on us, we have no hope. So do that. I think what we see here is their recognition that they're the ones who sinned against him, and it's up to him to be able to forgive and restore them. Any closing thoughts, final thoughts on Lamentations before we wrap it up? Get ready for Ezekiel on Sunday and then Daniel in a couple of Wednesdays. Go ahead. Yeah, how easy would it have been for him to have said, and just real quickly just said, "See, I told you so," and left it at that. All the things, you don't see that. The nearest that it comes to is, all this could have been avoided if you just would have listened. But he's not saying that from gloating over them. He's saying that just because, as Zachary said, how much he wanted this not to happen. He knew it was going to happen. But, you know, he's just looking around and saying, I tried to get you to understand this and you wouldn't listen. All this could have been avoided. So, yeah, good. All right. Well, thank you all very much for your participation.